To help you to remember this, I want to talk about the three little pigs. All of you know the story of the three little pigs and the big bad wolf. But do you know the true story of the three little pigs? This is a story by a gentleman by the name of Alexander Wolf. That's not his real name, but we'll use that for now. And this is the story of the three little pigs from the wolf's perspective. In this story, the wolf was a lovely young man, and he simply wanted to bake a cake for his granny for her birthday. But when he got out the ingredients, he realized he didn't have any sugar. So he went next door to his neighbor, who happened to be a pig, and not a very bright one because he had built his house out of straw. And while he was standing on the doorstep, he had a terrible sneeze because he had an awful cold, and the house fell down. And there in the middle was this dead little pig. He said, "Think of it like a giant cheeseburger. What would you have done?" And so he ate the little pig. Goes to the next house, and Wolf's honor, the same thing happens again. So he eats the second little pig. By the time he gets to the third house, he's really full, and he's beginning to think that maybe it wasn't such a great idea to make Granny a birthday cake. But he thinks, "I'll try one more time." So he knocks on the door of this pig's house. Now this has a brick house. And the pig inside says, "Go away, I'm shaving the hairs on my chinny chin chin." And the wolf says, "You know what? I think I will just make Granny a birthday card instead of a cake." So he yells to the wolf, "Okay, I was trying to make a birthday cake, but I'm just going to go away and make Granny a card." So he turns to go, but this little pig is rather rude, and he says, "And your old Granny can sit on a tack." Now, this wolf is usually very calm, but when someone insults his Granny, he loses it. So by the time the police got there, he really was huffing and puffing and trying to blow the house down. No one understood that the first two were totally accidents. He wants you to know that he was framed. Now, it's a silly story, but you'll remember the story, and I want you to remember that there's always another point of view. So that when you are ready to make a judgment on someone, try to understand the value system out of which they are operating. What's the motivation for what they are doing? It'll make us far more compassionate and far more understanding, also far more effective as we engage people in systemic change. Some of the problem areas that we encounter in culture, they are multiple, but I'd like to briefly go through six. First is the language. It's not just the language we speak. That certainly can be a barrier, because language shapes and mirrors the beliefs and values of a culture. For instance, some cultures don't have abstract concepts in their language. It's a very literal language. And so even when they learn English, they don't fully understand abstract concepts. Our perception is limited by the words that are available to us. Any of us who have attempted to learn or have learned a second language, unless we have immersed ourselves for many years in another country, we know that our vocabulary is far more limited in the second language than it was in our first. And we might have the idea that we want to share, but we don't always have the words with which to share it. Differences in language use among cultures can lead to crucial misunderstandings. Let me give you a couple examples. When I was principal of a school in Florida, I had 92% of our students were from other countries and spoke multiple languages. And I had a lovely young volunteer from Mexico. Her mother was from the state of Maryland. Her father was from the Yucatan Peninsula. She spoke absolutely perfect English. But she grew up in Mexico, so didn't have all the idioms that we are accustomed to in English. My parents at that time were living in a retirement community in Central Florida. And I invited her to come up for the weekend. And one of the other teachers who had come up with me in the past said, "You know, Chloe, you're not even old enough to swim in the swimming pool there." And I laughed and I said, "Yes, there are some pools there that are 30 and older. but there are family pools as well. And later, she didn't say anything then. She came to me later and she said, they have adult-only pools where your parents live? I said, yes, but don't worry about it. There are others as well. She said, do they swim naked there? And I laughed and I said, no. Her understanding of adult was like adult films, adult bookstores. She didn't have the other context to go with it. She didn't know anything about retirement communities in Florida. I will tell you that my parents' neighbors really enjoyed her take on the whole situation. Okay, let me give you a few other examples of language barriers. As a principal at the school, our students were in kindergarten through sixth grade. And one Saturday, we were going to have a meeting at the school. And I realized that the signs that said boys and girls had fallen off, and so I printed signs that said men and women and put them on the door. A short while later, Miguel comes to my office, and he's squirming all over the place. I said, Miguel, what's the matter? He said, I have to go to the bathroom. I said, Miguel, you know where the bathroom is. He says, I know, but now it says men and I'm only a boy. And I laughed and I said, it's still for you as well. And I thought, well, at least we've taught him to read. But again, he took the language very literally. A more important aspect of language than the language that we speak is our communication style. If there's one thing I learned in my doctoral program that was of the most value in understanding other cultures, it was communication styles. If we think of one as low context communication, and six as high context communication, and recognize that this has nothing to do with right or wrong or good or bad. It is simply how we have learned to communicate with each other. Low context communicators are very individual oriented and rely a great deal on words. They process with a linear logic, A to B to C. They tend to deal with conflict very directly. They're interested in facts. They focus on action and resolution, and they like open, direct strategies. High context communicators, on the other hand, are group oriented. They relied on a shared context for meaning. They use a spiral logic. So A goes to Q, goes to R, goes to F. To those in the low context group, they feel like they have no idea what they're talking about, but they do, because they have a shared context. They tend to deal with conflict indirectly. Remember when we talked earlier about the values of those in the lower socioeconomic class, that one of the key ones was relationships. Well, if relationships are to be preserved, the understanding here is that you don't deal with conflict directly. For those of us who come out of a low context culture, which is the dominant culture in the United States, that doesn't mean everybody adheres to it, but it is the dominant culture out of which we operate. We tend to say, stop beating around the bush. If you have something to say, say it. But someone operating out of a high context culture simply cannot do that. Okay, they are interested in saving face. Their focus is on relationship, and so they oftentimes use ambiguous, indirect strategies. Let me give you some examples here that might help to clarify this. I was giving a workshop in a diocese in the South. And when I do this over several days, I'm giving a cultural diversity workshop, and I give them a couple of hours on this communication styles, because I want them to truly understand what it means. And I want them to integrate it with what it will mean in the parishes within which they work and the social service agencies within which they work. And so this one particular time, I had about 100 people in the workshop. And I encouraged them to see where they fit on the scale of 1 to 6. And so the majority of them immediately went to the 1 and 2 area. Okay, I had about 5 or 6 out of 100 who went to the 5-6 area. A few went to the middle, but most realized that they don't operate in the middle. They have very strong feelings about this. And their task was to find 3 problems they were going to encounter with people who operated at the opposite end of the spectrum for them, and 3 ideas they could use to minimize the difficulties. And so I sent them off for half an hour to talk about this, gave them some newsprint to print their findings on. They came back together, and the large group of the ones and twos had given two people the responsibility for speaking for their group. Two men got up, they held up the paper, they said, "This is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem, and if everyone were like us, there wouldn't be a problem." And they sat down. That was their report. The five people from the 5-6 group got up. They all came up. They had not appointed a spokesperson. Their paper was totally blank. They said, "Well, we began to talk about this." And they then proceeded to relate the entire conversation they had about this. One of the gentlemen from the 1-2 group said, "You told us we had 5 minutes for this report, and they've already gone 5 minutes over." And I said, "If I had paid you to do this, I could not have done it any better." I said, "This is the difficulty in relating to people who come out of a different communication style." I said, "In our traditional communication style here, our dominant one, we like to go to a meeting, we like to have an agenda ahead of time, and we like to go through that agenda and come to some kind of a resolution by the time we get to the end. Is that correct?" "Yes." "However, if you're on the 5-6 end of the spectrum, you don't come to a meeting for the agenda. You come to the meeting to meet people. And you know what? They don't even care if they get to the agenda. Now, you've got all these people in your parishes. What are you going to do to make people feel invited and welcomed?" And so some of the initiatives that they came up with was, okay, we'll say the meeting starts earlier, and the first half hour of the meeting will be refreshments. And then after people have had an opportunity to talk with each other, we'll then go through the agenda. Then we'll have another half hour afterwards for people to socialize. So for those who just came for the agenda, they can leave. But for those who came in order to see people, they'll have the opportunity to do that. As the principal of the school in Florida, I realized that the traditional way of having parent-teacher conferences was never going to work because we usually schedule them 15 minutes apart. Well, I had 92% of my people who were at the high end of the spectrum, at the 5-6 level. So they would wander in and they would simply want to talk. So we scheduled two different parent-teacher conferences for those who wanted that specific time, and I knew would be on time. We scheduled one evening. They came, they had their 15 minutes, they went away, they were very happy. For the rest of the people, parent-teacher conferences were from 7 to 9. We set up refreshments in the courtyard. We put around chairs, and they walked in one by one. As somebody came out, somebody else would walk in. That way, everybody was happy. They had the time to talk. Nobody was in a hurry. For those for whom that wouldn't have worked, they had their scheduled 15 minutes. So we can make different types of accommodations. And we need to recognize that oftentimes when people come to us, they're coming out of an orientation toward high communication styles. And they really enjoy the opportunity to simply sit and chat with people. So we have to provide the opportunity for that as well.